My name is Valerie Ziegler-Morris, and this is a session on Christians and the state, in particular the biblical view of the people of faith and their relationship to the state. And I should say that this is my first time teaching here, and I feel really privileged to be here, although it was warm in Memphis when I left, and I was hoping, it was in the 90s, so I was hoping for something a little bit cooler, maybe not quite this cool. I'm privileged also to be talking to people of faith. I teach religion at a Presbyterian college, but they are required religion classes, and you know it's wrong to assume that they exist in order to make people believers. So as a result, even though we have very stimulating discussions, they're never the same kinds of discussions, and they never have the same issues of commitment that believers bring to those same issues. So I feel grateful to be speaking among you to other people of faith. And this is a five-part series studying the Christian's relationship to the state. And I guess the question that I bring to this is, you know, oftentimes, and you probably feel the same way, I often find myself in conflict between what I believe as a Christian and what I feel myself being called to do by my society. But I don't always feel myself in conflict. Sometimes I feel like, you know, the U.S. is right on and my community is doing things that I really approve of, and that seems really consistent with being a Christian. Other times I feel that the U.S. is building a big war machine and that, you know, I'm paying taxes to something that I think is morally wrong. And then I feel like, golly, you know, this being a Christian is totally inconsistent with this other role of being a citizen. So if you have those kinds of questions, what I propose to do is let's look at how other Christians, other believers, have tried to answer it, what they thought the proper role for them to take in relationship to their state was. And I'll be talking, but not exclusively at all. In fact, I'm sure that I'll learn as much from you as you do from me, so this is not a lecture, and I want you to jump in at any time. Let's start by thinking about the Old Testament, right? And you've got a little crypt sheet in front of you with some cleverly chosen passages from the Old Testament, but let me just ask you to buzz through your minds first. What was the relationship of the people of Israel to the state in the Old Testament? What can you think of? What, just any stories or passages or people that were important? Okay, who can name somebody that lived in the Old Testament? We'll start easy.
Moses.
Okay, Moses.
Good.
Very good. Actually, we are going to deal with Adam and Eve's relationship to the state, but that's not for two more sessions.
Oh, okay.
We'll talk about Moses first here. What was Moses' relationship to the state?
Rebel.
Rebel, okay. Why did Jeff say Moses was a rebel? Well, when Israel was in Egypt's land...
It was under slavery.
Yeah.
That's when he probably objected the most.
Yeah, he was under slavery. And go ahead.
And they were dominant. I mean, they just belittled the Israelites.
She really did, yeah.
The Egyptians did.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And so what happened? What's the story?
Well, he didn't try to overthrow it. He fled.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Didn't try to overthrow it. He fled. And he said that God was leading him. And there were a bunch of plagues and miracles and stuff like that to prove it. Okay, what happened to the Israelites after Moses led them through the wilderness for forever and ever and ever? And then Moses finally died. Then what happened next?
They became conquerors.
Yeah.
They became a state.
They became a state. Mm-hmm. That's right. In fact, do I have a volunteer to read a scripture passage?
Is it on the sheet, or do we have to look it up?
No, it's on the sheet. Somebody
it's the first
read.
One on the
yeah,
sheet.
The first one on the sheet. Go ahead, David. That's great.
Joshua attacked and captured.
Make it up.
Makkedah and its king that day. He put everyone in the city to death. No one was left alive. He did to the king of Makkedah what he had done to the king of Jericho. After this, Joshua and his army went on from Makkedah to Libna and attacked it. The Lord also gave the Israelites victory over this city and its king. They spared no one, but killed every person in it. They did to the king what they had done to the king of Jericho. After this, Joshua and his army went on from Libna to Lachish, surrounded it and attacked it. The Lord gave the Israelites victory over Lachish on the second day of the battle. Just as they had done at Libna, they spared no one, but killed every person in the city. Joshua conquered the whole land. He defeated the kings of the hill country, the eastern slopes and the western foothills, as well as those of the dry country in the south. He spared no one. Everyone was put to death. This was what the Lord God of Israel had commanded. Joshua's campaign took him from Kadesh Barnea in the south to Gaza near the coast, including all the area of Goshen and as far north as Gibeon. Joshua conquered all these kings in their territory in one campaign because the Lord, Israel's God, was fighting for Israel. After this, Joshua and his army went back to the camp at Gilgal.
Okay.
Take no prisoners.
Yeah, take no prisoners. What's the relationship there between being a citizen and being a person of the faith? What's God's relationship to this state, this group of people?
Identical.
Okay, good. Why does she say identical? Well, she has a college education, but beyond
she
that.
She went to school with you.
Because I flashed the hidden sign. No, what's identical about it?
God is a state.
Okay.
In a way,
mm-hmm.
You do as I say.
Yeah, it says God was fighting for Israel. And what's the result?
Victory won.
Victory, yeah. Complete victory. Complete victory. Total devastation. Now, most people usually have an emotional reaction to that passage.
Capital punishment.
It makes you think of capital punishment?
Yeah. God didn't spare him, but
mm-hmm.
kill him.
Mm-hmm.
No mercy.
No mercy. It reminds
me. What does this remind? It reminds me of Ronald Reagan talking about Soviet Union as the evil empire, and the United States as sort of the nation that's in God's grace.
Mm-hmm.
The same kind of
yeah, total identification.
Yeah, I mean, we're supposed to be.
And the origin of every holy war. I mean, this passage from here on justifies any holy war mm-hmm. that ever was. I mean, yes.
Does anybody feel uncomfortable with it? Sometimes people say things.
Does anyone feel comfortable?
You wonder if any war could be holy.
Well, the passage seems to say that it can be.
Yeah.
When God is fighting for Israel.
I think it's possible to be excited and cheering if you read the story on its own. On its own self-understanding, but mm-hmm. as soon as you start to think of what the implications are, you have difficulty with it. I think the problem with most of us here is that we read it, the deeper implications.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so glad we have that problem with it.
Yeah, sort of like if this were part of Star Wars, not Reagan's, but the movie, and this were like the climactic battle, it would be great. We would be cheering. The force is mm-hmm. on the right side. But when we think about the implications about war as complete and total, and about what it means when a people can claim to be so completely in the right that they can slaughter everyone, then most of us feel a little bit uncomfortable. But there it is. Okay, let me quiz your knowledge of the Old Testament here. Okay, I won't ask in particular, but what happened after the conquest? Then what kind of government?
Jewish
did the Israelites come to have?
Judges.
Good, judges. Okay, what were judges?
Oh, they were temporary viceroys of God for a crisis. They were laymen that took over.
Yeah. And Deborah. But yeah. No, that's right. There's sort of a cycle that the people would be faithful and everything was fine, and the people would be unfaithful and their enemies would gather, and then there would be a crisis and God would call a charismatic leader, called a judge. And the judge would whip everybody into line and conquer the enemies, and then the people would be faithful, and then they wouldn't, and then it would all start over again, the whole cycle. What put an end to the cycle? When did the Israelites move out of that kind of government into another kind?
Elected King Solomon.
Yeah, that's right.
Uh-huh. It would be like other countries are.
Good, yeah, you remember the story. The people came to Samuel and said, we want a king, like other nations have a king. And so eventually they got Saul, and then the next king, the really, really famous one, was
David,
and then his Solomon. Son, yeah, Solomon. So David and Solomon are really important kings in the Old Testament. Well, like, if you were the king in the Old Testament, what was it like? What were you supposed to do, or what did you get to do? What was your relationship to God like? And they're all just, you might look at the First Chronicles passage. Not to be too leading, but but all of us haven't read the whole Old Testament recently. Okay, what's the king's relationship to Yahweh, to God? Kissing cousins, people who admire each other. What's the image?
Carrier of the covenant.
Okay, yeah, that's real important. The king is the carrier of the covenant. In the second sentence of that first verse, the Lord, yeah, Father and Son. When the king was anointed, the king, in a sense, became God's Son. Not physically, of course. And he didn't become divine, but he had a special relationship to God. So close that he was God's Son. The king had a lot of power. If you read some of the stuff that Solomon did, you can see he had a lot of power. He had big power over taxing people, determining what jobs people had, what kind of work they had to do. But the king had responsibilities too. Who mentioned Keeper of the Covenant?
Mm-hmm.
Keeper of the Covenant. What did it mean to be Keeper of the Covenant?
Well, basically to know that they were the chosen, and that there was that they were to be a blessing. They would receive things like land and seed, people, and the promise that God would be with them, and they would be obedient and responsible.
I was wondering if it should be warmer if it was closed, that door.
Oh. You want to close the door? It might be warmer.
So they were supposed to hold on to the grace of God. That's why you have some trouble with this. Didn't God trust them? They had to slaughter everybody. I'm still back there.
Yeah, this is sort of a fast journey through the Old Testament.
I know they had to be separated in order to carry the covenant promise. But this seems a little bit ridiculous, but they had trouble later.
The kings, almost all the kings have trouble. They don't keep the covenant. And the king had enormous powers. I mean, the king is anointed as God's son. And nobody else had that relationship to God. But the king also had responsibilities, all revolving around the covenant. And if you'll just look at Psalm 72, that other passage there, the psalm lays out some of the things that the king is expected to do. Teach the king to judge with your righteousness, O God. Share with him your own justice, so that he will rule over your people with justice and govern the oppressed with righteousness. May the land enjoy prosperity. May it experience righteousness. May the king judge the poor fairly. May he help the needy and defeat their oppressors. All right, so that means the king had a lot of power, but the king didn't get to do just anything that he wanted with the power. What was a limit to his power? Or what was something he was supposed to think about when he exercised power?
Fairness.
Okay, fairness. What else?
Prosperity.
Okay, prosperity to who?
To the land.
Okay, to the land. Anybody else?
Justice.
Justice, uh-huh. Justice, prosperity. Who in particular gets mentioned several times?
The poor.
The poor. Yeah. Okay. Anybody in here ever been a school teacher? Okay. All right. When you go into class the first day, all right, and you go in and you set down the law, all right, now you can make any law you want, and as long as you're fierce enough, you can make the kids obey it. Okay. You got to be fierce. Especially grade school, high school, where they don't get to do teacher evaluations.
That's right.
That's particularly important. Now, when you exercise that kind of power, it can be unfair if you want it to be. It can sort of play up to the people who have the most gifts. It can be the meanest to the people who have the least to offer. Or you can have the kind of power that tries to empower those who have nothing. All right. I think at least this view of the king as keeper of the covenant meant that even though there is an entire identification between belonging to the Israelite faith and being a citizen of the king doesn't have the power to do anything that he wants. That power is always restricted by the covenant. And the covenant doesn't want just to make laws that create order. The covenant also wants to create justice so that there's fairness, like somebody said. And also not even just fairness, but also compassion, so that the poor and the needy and the oppressed all are considered, and that they too can dwell in the land in prosperity. All right, so we've got really, there's a identification between being a citizen and being a person of the faith. The king has tons of power, but it's not arbitrary power, or at least it's not supposed to be. All right, flip side. That was the Old Testament. When you only have an hour, you have to cruise the Bible rapidly.
We got a blank flip side. Oh, I don't know what that means.
Well,
it means you have the original.
It means that you're not in the church. I don't know. Okay, here are some suggested crypt passages, but there are a lot of others that you could think of on your own. Think about the New Testament. It's shorter, and we read it more, so you know it better. What are some things that the New Testament, that Jesus or Paul say for about how a believer is supposed to relate to the government?
Supposed to pay his taxes.
Okay.
Well, you're supposed to pay to the government what is due to the government,
okay.
But to God.
Mm-hmm. Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, mm-hmm. And unto God the things that are God's. And of course, Jesus doesn't tell us what's what, but we get the idea, we think. All right, that's a very famous passage, probably the most famous one.
Everything is God's.
Everything is God's? Okay, Barbara wants to be a radical and say that by the time you give God what is God's, there won't be anything left for Caesar.
No, not necessarily, but it's all God's.
But it's all God's to start with. Okay. look at the crypt sheet or think of other passages, but what are some other things that come to your mind when you think about the New Testament and what it says about our relationship to the state?
The conflict of the state under God and the state under the Romans. And the, somebody becomes the oppressor, and what do you do with that?
Yeah.
Just go back here to Joshua.
And have a holy war. Well. What about the Sermon on the Mount? Let's start there. Lots of times, people who say, I really want to be serious about being a Christian, often go to the Sermon on the Mount because there they find a way of life that seems to them to sum up what it is to be a Christian. What might you learn about your relationship to the state from the Sermon on the Mount?
Do not resist one who is evil.
Okay. Do not...
If someone asks you to go 1 mile, go two.
How do you relate that to the state?
Because it was the Roman custom to make people walk. You had to carry something 1 mile for somebody. So that you subvert that by going second.
Let's talk about just soldiers for a minute. Okay, we've already seen Joshua and the soldiers marching in. What's the purpose of soldiers? Well, generally they don't exist because everything is wonderful. They exist because people perceive dangers, either from other countries or sometimes within their own country. And soldiers are supposed to ward off that danger. Okay, does that make sense? Okay, lots of times, they do that violently. That's why they have weapons. All right. What does it mean when Jesus says, don't resist evil with evil? If someone slaps you on the right cheek, turn your other cheek and let that person slap your left cheek too. What's the connection there between what soldiers do, and soldiers are a part of the government, and what Jesus is saying? Okay, how many people think that those two things, that soldiers and what they do, and Jesus and what he says, agree with each other? Now let's see hands. It's so much better when we have hands.
I don't think they have conflict. It doesn't have to be conflict.
Okay, it doesn't have to be. Talk
no,
some more.
It has to be.
Why not? He raised his hand. He said he thought it was a conflict. You say it isn't. Why not?
Jesus didn't try to overthrow the government.
That's true.
So, in other words, he wasn't condemning it.
But God still rules.
Mm-hmm.
Even he might permit us to do other things, but he still rules.
Mm-hmm.
He uses even the bad.
Okay, so you're saying God uses the government. And...
But there's still the dichotomy between a soldier, I mean, I think if this is the point you're trying to get to, that a soldier would never turn the other cheek if he was slapped, or I mean, the army does not exist to be shot at and not to shoot back.
Right.
Whereas the story is saying, for to attain happiness, the sermon is saying that this is indeed what you should do. Therefore, I mean, that it's not that there's a conflict as much as that there are different charges, different things that you're supposed to go after, different ways you respond to stimulus.
Well, it might be a difference between being a Christian and being a soldier. A soldier wouldn't necessarily have to be a Christian.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
He could be an arm of the government, or he is an arm of the government.
But what are we as Christians to think then about soldiers?
Should be there for our good and for protection.
Okay. And don't let me make it appear as though I have an answer or that you're supposed to. I mean, I'm not trying to answer
this.
You're
trying to get
my
answer.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like what the dynamic is that there's a suddenly the people of God no longer have power, and therefore there has to be some kind of way of dealing with power. Right? So, by what you read in the New Testament, at least something like the Sermon on the Mount and a few other places, you see that this new movement, whatever it is one that has chosen, consciously chosen, not to be powerful.
All right. The state has power, and in order to keep it, will fight off anyone who tries to take it away. The Sermon on the Mount is saying, don't grasp for power. If someone uses evil against you, don't use their methods in return. Refuse to be evil. The implication being that when the state uses power in a violent manner, the state isn't using power as God would have us use power.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What about Jesus is going into the temple?
Yeah, people always bring that one up.
Well,
go for it.
Well, yeah. I love it. He certainly became a soldier at that point, in a sense, right? Using physical force to express his anger.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't tell us what the people did. They were probably in such a state of shock they couldn't retaliate, but if he'd stayed around, it might have been the end of him there.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we look at that in terms of what he says?
Yeah, good question. Who wants to answer?
My sense is it's more of a symbolic gesture than anything else, because we guess that the people are back the next morning, so that if Jesus were serious about using power, he would have had the disciples. I mean, there would have been a big coup to hold the temple for 40 days if they could, you know, keep other people out, etc. It seemed like what he was trying to make a point, and maybe he simply was just angry. It might have been the anger of the moment. It's certainly in John's gospel. Is it in John's? In John's gospel, it's the reason they crucify him.
But you're suspecting that...
Well, I'm just thinking that maybe there comes a point when the soldiers, a collection of soldiers, can use force righteously.
Mm-hmm.
The point is to get the state to control themselves and use their power as Christ would have it used. Certainly, if
mm-hmm.
we saw our government cremating or having crematoriums
mm-hmm.
and disposing of the American Indians in that way, whatever, it would be up to us as a community to prevent that somehow,
mm-hmm.
or at least try, even if we were all shot down.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have a responsibility to see that our government acts within certain guidelines of love
mm-hmm.
and commitment.
Mm-hmm.
I think that.
Right.
I think that holds true with the church too. Jesus went into the synagogue and did this. Not that we should go in and upset tables and trash the place, but I think that we should voice our opposition to what we feel is wrong in the church today.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Jesus was a demanding respect for God's house.
Mm-hmm.
And let me make put an example. Some time ago, someone was trying to sell some chance tickets within the church, after church. I couldn't do it because this is God's house. It's
mm-hmm.
a wrong place for it.
Mm-hmm.
That's my feeling.
Didn't feel right. What? How did Jesus die? Let me just pop that question at you.
Why did Jesus die?
No, how did Jesus die?
Crucified.
Yeah, as a criminal, crucified. What kind of resistance did he put up?
None.
A lot of early Christians took that really seriously, combining that with the Sermon on the Mount. and they said, here's the sermon where he says, don't return evil for evil. All right? Here's the situation where great evil was done to him. And what he didn't do is say, oh, I take back the sermon. Instead, he refused to return evil for evil and even went to his death. They found that to be enormously compelling. All right? It seemed as though perhaps the work of the government was just a work that wasn't the same as what Jesus did. It was a violent work, and they felt that they couldn't participate in that kind of work. Probably the most famous passage in Christian history, at least, about the state comes from Romans 13. And if you don't know it right off the top of your head, you'll know it after we talk about it. Paul says, everybody must obey state authority because no authority exists without God's permission. And the existing authorities have been put there by God. He goes on to say, therefore, that's why you should pay your taxes. Or don't fear the state, because only those who have done things have reason to fear the state. The magistrate, the ruler, is God's authority, and you should obey the ruler for that reason. How do you feel about that one?
Terribly uncomfortable.
Terribly.
I think that could apply at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't go along with it right now. And I don't.
I don't know if it could apply.
I'm not sure if you have. I mean, efforts at building an institution, getting an institution to be accepted and not outside of the realm and sort of calm everything down. And I think Paul took a big chunk out of what we just talked about, the Sermon on the Mount and the crucifixion weren't two different things.
Go ahead.
I guess one of the more convincing statements I've heard on this has to do with essentially saying that Paul really absolutely believed this, and that he saw the Roman Empire with all of its evils and everything else as really ordained by God to bring order to the world at that particular time. That it was extremely orderly, that it did keep peace in one sense of that word, and that Paul really saw the coming of the kingdom, the second coming of Christ, as very imminent. I mean, it was going to happen within a few years, and that the Roman Empire was the instrument of God to maintain that kind of order so that people could get their personal lives in order then to be prepared for that. And that there was much less of a concern about the justice of the state and of a society, of oppression and justice within society, because that wasn't going to matter anymore anyway in a short period of time. And the most important thing was to provide, again, order so that people could concentrate on their own moral lives. And so that was the purpose of the state, and was to provide that. And that was certainly ordained by God to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I think to see it in that context makes a lot of sense. It doesn't necessarily mean that we can just lift this out then and say, but that's the case now.
Why wouldn't it be true now?
Yes.
I don't personally think that it is, because I think that I don't believe that I don't live in the hope that Jesus is going to return next week. Maybe he will. But I feel like my call from the gospel is to live my life as though this world is that Jesus is already present in this world now, and that I am to be an instrument of bringing about that reigning of what I see in the gospel and the Old Testament telling me means to be a community and a society of shalom, of peace and justice, and that is something that exists now. I do not see most of the governments of this world as being divinely ordained to do that. And in fact, I think this contradicts, if we take this simply as it stands, I think it contradicts mostly what I think Jesus taught us, as well as what the community in the Old Testament, what the covenant was all about. So I don't think it stands in the sense that every state exists only with God's permission, and that therefore we obey everything that goes. I think we're called almost sometimes to be just the opposite, that we're called to be respectful perhaps at different times, but also to be communities of that are not status quo.
Challenge
that try to break down the structures that are oppressive.
Well, personally, I don't see any difference in the Roman government and the governments that we have nowadays, especially the communist regime. They're against God. So was the Roman government.
Mm-hmm. Although Paul doesn't seem to be saying here that he sees the Roman government as against God. He seems to be saying that the Roman government really responds. It's somehow the instrument of God. Yeah. Although I think you're right, there are other passages that we can look at, and we will, that disagree with that. Paul seems to be pretty high on the Roman government.
Paul's very proud of being a Roman citizen.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
He talks about that a lot.
And of course, I mean, Paul's also writing, at least in part, to try to demonstrate that Christians aren't a seditious group, that they deserve the protection of the government, that they will be good citizens. And it's true, in chapter 14, he goes right along and he goes into his, but remember, salvation is nearer to us now than when we first believed, the night is far gone, the day is at hand. He clearly did think that Christ would be returning soon. But he's laid down an ethic that really prizes order. And I think nobody would want to live in chaos. And he sees order as a gift of God. But we see in Romans 13 very little of that emphasis on covenant, justice, kindness to the oppressed, fairness. Paul's not much worried about justice here. He's very worried about order. Doesn't talk too much about justice. A famous passage that early Christians always balanced Romans 13 with was Acts 5:29. That's a real short snippet. But essentially it is, Peter says, we must obey God, not human beings. And Paul talks about the problem as well, as what if you're ever asked to do something that you as a Christian simply feel is against your faith? What should you do? Do you remember? Do you overturn the government? Do you do it? Do you not do it? You know, what if the state comes to you and says, we've decided to sacrifice firstborn males this year? And you say, no, I don't think that my faith lets me do that. What do you do next?
Send them down the river.
and we're back to Moses. See, the Bible is just a seamless web. And now he says, don't do it. Don't do something that's against your faith. But don't be violent about it either. Simply politely refuse, respecting the authority over you, and expect to be punished. So Paul's not into rebellion, all right, in any sense. But I will tell you, throughout Christian history, no passage has been more important than this Romans 13 passage. when Christians have tried to think about what it means to live in a state that is somehow related to God's rule in the world. And Romans 13 is a real conservative passage. A lot there about order, really nothing much about justice. Now, another very famous passage, and you can probably guess which one is left, way over on the end, that Christians have also used when they talked about government is another chapter 13. But this one's from the book of Revelation. And like much of Revelation, it's very symbolic, mainly inexplicable, but essentially what seems to be going on here is that this beast seems to stand for the Roman Empire. Of course, the writer of Revelation was, he's stranded on an island in exile, and he's foreseeing a great persecution. Remember? And in Revelation 13, he talks about the beast that will initiate this persecution. And he says, verse 5, the beast is allowed to make proud claims. It's allowed to have authority. Of course, authority is a buzzword. We've seen that in Romans 13. It's allowed to fight against God's people and to defeat them. It's given authority over every tribe, nation, language, and race. All people living on earth will worship it, except for those who were called. And those people, he says, listen in verse 9, listen if you have ears. Whoever is meant to be captured will surely be captured. Whoever is meant to be killed by the sword will surely be killed by the sword. This calls for endurance and faith on the part of God's people. And it goes on to describe that the beast will demand worship. All right. And biblical scholars think that they're talking about emperor worship there. Well, that's all sort of weird. But what kind of view of that is, what's that view of the state like? Let's start easy. Good or bad?
Doesn't sound very good.
Yeah, it's not very good. Not very good at all. In fact, it sort of reminds me of what you were saying earlier when you were talking about how you feel that some states are godless and they rule, but they don't deserve our respect in some way. This is a state that's gone nuts. I mean, it's so far removed from what God's will for the creation is that it literally is an anti-state. It is a beast. It has authority, and we know from Romans 13 that real states have authority, and the authority comes from God, but it misuses that authority, demands worship. And so what are Christians supposed to do in response?
Endure.
Okay, again, endure. Stay faithful. This is about the most negative view of the state you're going to find in the New Testament. Calling it the Antichrist is fairly negative. And people are supposed to endure. But notice even here, the passage doesn't call for people to rebel, does it? Or have a revolution. Christians tend to write real conservatively, actually, about government. It says the state is of the devil. But endure. Remain faithful. Expect to be persecuted. Expect to suffer. But endure. Well, what kind of conclusions should we be drawing? I mean, we've looked at a ton of stuff. We looked at holy war. We've done kingship with the covenant. We've got non-resistance, the Sermon on the Mount. We've got Romans 13, government ordained by. We've got Revelation 13. Government has authority, yet it's of the devil. What kind of conclusions are we supposed to be drawing from that? You know, people always say, well, if you got a question, go to the Bible. Okay, we did. What did we find?
More questions.
All right, but Now, let's see, is anyone planning on living at Holden for the rest of their lives? Nobody? Okay, so we're all going. Yeah. We hope no one will be here. So we're eventually going out there back into the world, some of us sooner than others. What are we supposed to think about the state? What's the biblical view of the state?
Well, one thing that Susan said is that I think is consistent in just about all of these is that the view of personal personal strength and what that is different than what the state has for a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
If you could take Romans 13 and you're just sort of giving it without even questioning, giving the authority to the people in power, because mm-hmm. that's what's ordained. But even in Revelation, it's endurance that's valued. It's not the ability to strike back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Jesus said, carrying the cross.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's right. And a lot of early Christians in New Testament times thought that, you know, being a citizen was part of carrying the cross, that you could just expect that the state was going to oppose you. But it seems to me that maybe that Old Testament model doesn't put a dichotomy between personal strength and the character of the state. Remember, you know, what's the king supposed to be about? What's the state supposed to be about? If you were a really good citizen in Israel, would there be any tension between being a really good citizen and being a really faithful member of the Israelite religion?
In the best of all possible.
In the best of all possible worlds. Solomon on a good day. Solomon on a good day, say, when he had his justice and compassion there with his order.
What about Pilate and Christ when they're talking about kingdom? He says, "Are you a king?" And he said, "Yeah." If you, you know,
yeah.
He just said so.
Mm-hmm.
But my kingdom is not of this world. Else my servants would fight.
Yeah, that's right.
So there is the right of a kingdom within a larger kingdom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the one passage we didn't talk about, this 1 Peter 2, mentions that you are a chosen race, a holy nation, God's own people, chosen to proclaim the wonderful acts of God. That certainly early Christians had a real sense that they were a special people called out, different from everybody else. And it seems like what you're saying is perhaps some of that difference means that they weren't concerned with the affairs of the state, temporal affairs that just fell below the standards that they expected of themselves. Is that what you said?
I don't know, but I wouldn't say they weren't concerned, because mm-hmm. if you're going to proclaim, if you're going to be the witnesses, you need to, sometimes you witness under persecution, because you mm-hmm. hope that you could take the roads and get to the next place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You still hope for endurance.
Yeah, you hope for endurance.
But aren't we the state?
Yeah, actually we are.
Mm-hmm.
So it's our responsibility to be different than we have been.
But it's a very different time. I mean, many years have passed between the time of Jesus and our time. But I think that Jesus, speaking to his followers, was trying to to get people to focus away from trying to take temporal power, because that was an option at that time, which Jesus clearly rejected.
I mean, it was something that some of his followers probably wanted him to do. In fact, they were probably very disappointed. They, even up to Gethsemane, somebody pulled a sword in Gethsemane. They still wanted him, because at that point, they still there may have been people among him, his followers, who felt that there's enough of us to really pull this off. But I think Jesus really did. I think the people following Jesus had some difficult stuff to try to figure out with the state, but I think up until the time of Jesus' death and resurrection and ascension, that Jesus was not, Jesus, I think, was trying to focus them on God's righteousness and Jesus' own action to give them a sturdy, some kind of sturdy basis from which they could do that thinking, later thinking that they would have to do up until our own time about what it means to be members of the state. But I don't think that Jesus gave them a sort of clear answer.
But wouldn't he have known that at that point they weren't ready to accept his taking over power in a non-violent way? I mean, they didn't have any sense of that. They were thinking in terms of violence and kingship that rode out, people rode on the white horses and conquered, and that with spears and swords. But today, I thought you were talking about today. What do we do about this today? And it seemed, sounded like we were separating ourselves from the state. And I think we are. We have the responsibility to see that the help of the kingdom come by the way who we vote for, by what we think, by putting down arms and saying we refuse to fight, or whatever it is that we need to do in order to have God's kingdom.
Well, why don't we wait until next time and see what the early Christians did? What can I say? Thank you for talking. And I think maybe one of the best ways to figure out how to apply the scriptures is to see how Christians have done it. And that's what we'll do in the next four sessions.